Okay, thank you everyone. I'm really excited to be here again. Yesterday was awesome, the day before was awesome, and today will be the most awesome, I guess. The title has changed. I thought it was, because I always had this quote in the... Oh, sure. I always had this quote by Lionel Fogarty in the paper, but I realised it made a great title, a better title. So it's now renamed The Comic Scenario Towards a Commons, quote, No Colony Can Con. The comic scenario of Australian poetry stages, I think, a transnational commons of indeterminate relation to the nation state, where terms other than national literary citizenship are circulated. Such a commons, in my view, works towards what Lionel Fogarty in poem Advance of Those Asian and Pacific Writers Poets has theorised as a future, quote, no colony can con. Now, comic scenario here means two things. A, the comic scenario as it appears internally in works of poetry, and B, the comic scenario of poetry's spheres, its spaces of circulation and reception. Indeed, the interchangeability and difference between A and B for contrasting poetic approaches and agents reveals a broader metatextual investment of Australian poetry in the field of Australian literature. So what I vaguely mean by that is that I think Australian poetry intervenes on the notion of Australian literature quite a bit. We really care about this, I think. Now, to what extent these examples develop comedy, a genre, and a different operation to the comic scenario, and also different again to humour, is a theoretical horizon of this scholarly project. The project proposes to illustrate how, following philosopher and Lacanian Alenka Zupanchik's theory of the comic, as a sustained, incommensurate encounter of the subject with otherness, the comic realises zones of interaction which suggest the development of commons. What Heidi Sohn, Stavros Kosoulas and Gerhard Bruns have defined as, quote, a differentiated form of publicness. This is not a paper about irony or satire. And I've been talking to a lot of people lately, inspired by others, and how I really think they're radically different, and it's important to remember why they're different, and how, in many ways, irony is so important that when we don't talk about it, I want to be clear that I'm not talking about it. It is a paper about zones of signification, which in the aesthetic realm obey orders of the comic rather than other forms of literary citizenship. A delimited conclusion for today's paper is that the comic scenario of Australian poetry stages what I think is a crucial element of comedy's framing of subjectivity and otherness for Zupanchik, namely that it stages our ignorance of, quote, the real of what happened, and succeeds in displaying the crack in the midst of our most familiar realities. I want to suggest that contemporary Australian poetry's often axiomatic anti-state rhetoric and self-deprecating intellectualism stem from a deeper investment in dramaturgies of the comic. Today it seems to me urgent to recover the far more established relationship comedy has to civil disobedience, past and present, the threshold of cultural inheritance and subjectivation. Now, as you might anticipate if you're a reader of Australian poetry, such an approach carries the whiff of the work of influential late 20th century poet, early 21st century poet, Michael Farrell, and its ideal subject. For reasons somewhat like Jacques Derrida's reluctance to write about Samuel Beckett, Michael Farrell, in my case, is, quote, an author to whom I feel very close, or to whom I would like to feel myself very close, but also too close. Precisely because of this proximity, it is too hard for me, too easy, and too hard. So through this theory...
I can stand up safely.
So through this theory of the comic scenario of Australian poetry is somewhat instigated by Michael Farrell's poetry and also a number of half-baked or still mentally enclosed readings of he and others, such as Ken Bolton, Wu Yang Yu, Kerry Glastonbury, Anya Volvitz, Pam Brown, Duncan Hose, Anne Vickery and Cameron Lowe. Today I will present two representative readings and kind of easy readings, so I apologise for the obviousness of the readings, I guess, but I want to do that because all of us, so many of us are very literate in the things that I'm talking about, but then, you know, here we are in Berkeley, so I want to like invite people who are new to poetry as well. So I want to give two kind of obvious examples. And they come from Sam Wagan Watson, really awesome poem, and Gig Ryan, another awesome poem, which we'll see in a moment, which each in radically different ways stage incommensurations between national spheres or practices and subjects in some state of alterity. What the most exigent politics to emerge in a given transnational sphere is highly contentious, and which I believe poetry must have a problematic relation to sustain an aesthetic counterpart, which transformatively reviews the spatiotemporal imaginaries that emerge by collision and interaction. So as much as heterotopia be a means of reading a commons, I think we should be as interested in, to quote the title of a poem by Kerry Glastonbury, one of the best contemporary centos, the schmutopia. Why? Glastonbury's commitment to the provincial's re-territorialisations of transnational interactions into an intimacy of the trivial is aptly summarised in this poem, Schmutopia, as a trial of empire, something common to many states with the trace of colonialism toggling their history. I was supposed to put this in the slide, but I didn't. Anyway, I'll try to read it well. See me to the witness box at the trial of an empire. The crime? Uncontrollable all-inclusiveness and a weak backhand. Some things that must be worked against. So quickly, I'm just going to jump into a theory of the commons that I'm using. This is Stavros Stavrides' theory of the commons. Now, in my reading, theorist of architecture and political space, Stavros Stavrides, defines a rarely considered conjunction between aesthetics and politics in his theory of the commons and the action of commoning public and private space by movements such as Occupy. At the end of his essay, titled Common Space as Threshold Space, Urban Commoning in Struggles to Reappropriate Public Space, Stavrides writes in relation to events of reclamation that have gone on particular to Greece during its debt crisis, nodding to philosopher Henri Lefebvre that a commons is a zone of art. Perhaps what the collective experiments with space commoning during this crisis modestly suggest is the possibility of reclaiming the city as a collective work of art. And I just suddenly burst into my head, you know, who over the conference has best shown this? Natalie Harkin's projections onto the buildings in South Australia. Perfect example, I think. Talking back. Art and Stavrides' usage suggests non-economic, autonomous signifying of subjective relations in a particular enclave within a broader network of socio-cultural and spatio-temporal forces. Earlier in the essay, Stavrides explores the ways in which actors within emergent commons are made to reconsider the subject positions that they bring with them to its nascent representations of roles and purposes. If a commons is to function open-endedly and without deadline, to have its own autonomy and continue to transform in such a way that it subjectivises its participants in the process of spatial change, he writes, is this not a prospect that would transform city space into common space, into space as commons? So via Stavrides and the Phantom of Lefebvre, we could say today that in such spaces, aesthetics and politics not only intersect but cross-contaminate in a field of signification. I think I might jump ahead a bit so that I can make sure I do the readings. Okay. Oh, one thing. So the making of a commons is also the, quote, power to create new institutions of commoning. In this sense, Stavrides is interested in modes of signification which prove to cross economic, social, cultural, and contextual divides, a means of remaking the meaning of space and whose transformative effects decide the terms of new interaction. Such zones have provided sanctuary from economic and social injunctions of productive, utilitarian, monocultural citizenship. So I want to consider the comic scenario of Australian poetry as imposing analogous demands upon citizenship and the civil subject. Okay. So I'm going to jump ahead to the poems. Now, the first comic scenario I want to consider is Cheap White Goods at the Dreamtime Sale by poet Sam Wagan Watson. What is comic in this poem is a reversal of the colonial and neo-colonial approaches to taste, curatorship, and archive when interacting with indigenous practices and artefacts, with the poem's persona investigating the authenticity claims of white goods, whilst deploying a familiar lexicography of the pseudo-anthropological and highly commoditized perspectives of the neo-colonial Western tradition-biased curator towards Indigenous things. The poem opens with a lushly drawn but absurd science fiction scenario which flows over an enjambed but unstopping notion of future curatorship. Okay, so this is the poem. This is the beginning of the poem. If only the alloy-winged angels could perform better and lift Uluru, a site with grandeur, the Neolithic additive missing from that seventh wonder of the world expo, under the arms of a neon goddess, under the hammer in London, murderers turning trustees, possession, a possession from a death estate, maybe flogged off to the sweet seduction of yen, to sit in the halls of Swiss Bank, or be paraded around Paris Left Bank, where the natives believe that art breathed for the first time. Besides the denotative quality of comedy here, see, I read it so soberly, I ruined it. It's much funnier, you know, you can tell. It's much funnier than the way I read it. I'm sorry, Sam. Besides the denotative quality of comedy here, watching the image of Uluru flout the boundaries of scale as it shrinks to the size of a foyer object or cosmically float with a neon goddess, the reader also experiences Uluru as some kind of guiding, picaresque character, the quixotic, actually, now that I think about it. Yeah. The concrete and limited doing the work of the universal and the incredible is a guiding principle of Alenka Zupanchik's theory of comedy. And it is on these terms that Wagan Watson exemplifies the powers of characterization inherent to comedy, with Uluru becoming the means of a comic scene which demolishes the market-based aesthetic principles of the modern art world. Zupanchik writes, "Comedy involves a strange coincidence of realism. It is supposed to be more realistic and down-to-earth than, say, tragedy, and utter unrealism, defying all human and natural laws and getting away with things that one would never get away with in real life, like sending Uluru to the Paris Left Bank. This unrealistic, incredible side of comedy is also related to its proverbial vitalism, a kind of undead, indestructible life, a persistence of something that keeps returning to its place no matter what." I hope that makes sense. So I think the contrary notion of both going beyond but also suggesting its origin and its place. It transports in a different sense. Uluru, an enormous sacred site at the centre of the Australian continent, here, even as it is science fictionalised, as some kind of entrapped artefact shipped to Europe, becomes the impetus for a second long critique, enjammed but unbroken in thought. Now, it continues, I don't have it on there, but it continues. Culture, bohemian and bare and maybe brutal, and how the critics neglect the Rubenesque roundness of a Bora ring, unfolded to an academia of art. Yes, that pure soil in front of you. The dealers in Manhattan lay back and vomit. They're the genius behind dot paintings and ochre handprints, rattling across studios from the east side to the village and across the arse of designer jeans. Cheap white goods at the Dreamtime sale. The hypercritical speaker of this poem, rather than oppose the movement of Uluru as a transnational agent, turns the tastemakers on themselves, as if from the bird's eye view of this unbound Uluru. The poem's punchline, also the epigrammatic volta which enlightens us to the opening found at the end of this brief dystopia, is an evaluation of the commoditized art market so synonymous with its social scene, summarized as, quote, white goods. Again, Indigenous Australian cultural artefacts and practices supplant the auditors of taste, Wagan Watson imagining the indigenous cosmology of the Dreamtime in the role of arbitrating the circulation of white commodities. Okay, so I'm going to jump to the second reading of a Gig Ryan poem. It's called Travellers from the New World, from Pure and Applied. The voice of the line, that's right, I moved the quote out. There's a line, the final line of the poem, Travellers from the New World, is, I thought there'd be more history here. And it's a line about Europe, so ostensibly an Australian visitor to Europe, a Philistine who has gone to Europe. I thought there would be more history here. The voice of this line is clearly a new world Philistine as they visit sites of the old world Europe. The dastardly humour at play here is involved again in inversion, like Sam Wagan Watson's. This time, the profound irony of a citizen of the new world's louche lack of global literacy and historical sensibility in Europe, striving to discover history as if it were a destination or commodity. A subject who also happens to be an occupier of First Nations space in their home country, occupier of the lands of the very oldest of civilizational frameworks. The inversion then doubles back on itself, as much a joke about historically illiterate and uncultivated Philistines who assume history does not happen to them but happens to the other. It also implicates the roots of colonization, an echo of Eurocentric colonial perspectives towards First Nations peoples as the Philistine searches for recognizable objects of history that might orient them in time. As I've argued elsewhere in an article on Ryan's work, Ryan's anachronism, more broadly, is a political modality, deconstructing the semiotic terms by which classical figures and narratives recur in our political imagination. Here, the anachronism is not overt, but implied in a faulty sensibility. Where are the signs of history? I was expecting more, wonders the time-fractured post-colonial subject. The comic scenario of Travellers from the New World wages a reversal of the assumption that Europe is a master signifier of world culture, and the concomitant situation of the New World agent as a reverent. Noticeably, a poem which restages a series of broken remarks, vaguely attributable to a New World tourist, visiting England, Switzerland, Italy, begins with a familial injunction to discover roots for the speaker, which for Ryan's speaker is the sod in Ireland. The folks expect you to kiss the sod in Ireland. I tried to feel their link and pith. The materialism of the reference here, the sod, which is associated with the supposed pith of the speaker's parents, overwhelms and obfuscates any felicity in this version of subjectivation. Sod is too wet and earthy a substitute for roots. Pith overdetermines origin as heart, using a masticated fruit metaphor which is visceral and nearly excremental. Ryan's namesake being Irish, the reader is encouraged by the poem to associate the poet with these acts of self-identification. The materialism of the speaker's verbs, later stuff, sack me, sonking through, shell out, all suggest the gut reactions of a critical observer with little regard for respectful criticism. The liveliness but hastiness of criticism crafts an ambiguous Antipodean subject, candid and vulgar, writhing under the gravity of Eurocentrism, and a particularly Australian conception of Eurocentrism at that. We know this by the next two lines. The first is reminiscent of Paul Giles' use of the concept of the Antipodean to talk back to colonial history, the second deploying an Australianism. Sorry, I did have the quote. Anyway, I had that quote. Oh, there we go, that's the one I want. England was Antipodean must, Switzerland was grass. Viewing England as Antipodean must situates the sensibility of the speaker as parochial, viewing association against the grain of succession as if England were an aged Antipodes. It is a very strange notion that someone would view England as the trace, a must or mould of the Antipodes, a term expected to work precisely in the reverse. Again, a sign of the poem's reversal of the Eurocentric conditions of Australian subjectivities, Antipodean must destabilises history's assumed authority over cultural memory. A series of wry commentaries that view the speaker and also a random American couple who delegate who should do the inside and who should do the outside of a presumably famous site, establish a fairly uninterested and alienated audience to Europe's antiquity. What is uninteresting about the old world, a Eurocentric conception of history, and ultimately funny about this inversion? Well, how the poet's persona views the old world in conclusion is the destination of the comic scenario, I think. Its vulgar materialism and vibrant disdain for tourism culminates in a punchline, just as we saw in other poems. In the other poem, I mean. The poem concludes, after all the gutsy verbs, "I thought there'd be more history here." The wonderful face value stupidity of this remark conceals a secret ingenuity tied to the transnational encounter in which this comic subject inadvertently cognizes a disjunction between old and new worlds within the colonial frame. It is not enough for post-colonial writing to oppose neo-colonialism to conceptualise a commons that no colony can con, to quote Lionel Fogarty again. Modes of signification endure if there is not a concomitant defamiliarisation and estrangement of the terms of colonial thinking. Ryan plays out one with the comic subject of travellers from the New World, and it involves what Zupančič has called the comic's proverbial vitalism, a kind of undead, indestructible life. I'm just about to finish. Now, as Zupančič writes, comedy reveals, quote, "the real of what happened, succeeds in displaying the crack in the midst of our most familiar realities." The coordinates of cultural capital here comically decentered. So that's really my point, the decentering of the cultural capital of the Eurocentric Australian literary tradition. Properly comic in characterisation, Ryan's poem speaks to the political dramaturgy behind the bad sensibilities of the Australian Philistine. And also, we could very much say the same, though in a different frame, of the bad sensibilities of the person who commoditises Aboriginal artefacts. So in this particular transnational disjuncture, national sensibilities, quote, national... Oh, sorry, that's not a quote, that's me. National sensibilities of the New World subject clang. Their cultural capital bankrupt, but a figure emerges, I hope, who no colony can con. Thank you very much.